The Loose Cannons Podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
I'm just a potato eater, but isn't it simple as 1, 2, 3? 1. The working conditions are bad. 2, they're bad because the mob does the hiring. And 3, the only way we can break the mob is to stop letting them get away with murder. Now, if one of you would just answer one question, we'd have a start, a very good start. And that question is, who killed Joey Doyle? Not one of you has a line on who killed Joey Doyle?
Hey everybody, it's another Loose Cannons podcast coming at you, and we have a special surprise for you today. Ilya's back.
Hello!
We're all so happy
to have
our best voice, literally best voice, back on the podcast.
Yeah, and slightly shittier quality because I don't have my microphone with me, so I'm just recording off my laptop. So it's it's a good voice, but it's in shitty quality.
We're happy. Speaking of,
hear them no matter how compressed they are.
Great voices. Today we're going to be discussing 1954's On the Waterfront, directed by Ilya Kazan, continuing in our AFI 100 Years, 100 Films continued countdown. But before we do that, let's do this. It's a little segment we like to call Heralds and Announcements. Boop, It's too bad we'll probably never get to do a live podcast, so you guys will never see that Patrick always wiggles his eyebrows every time that it comes to Heralds and Announcements.
Yep. It always excites my eyebrows.
Patrick, would you like to herald or denounce a movie?
Yeah, sure. I'll denounce a movie, another AFI movie, one called The Best Years of Our Lives.
Boom.
Yeah, from 1946, directed by William Wyler.
The Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah, I actually kind of went into this with high hopes because I had seen clips from it on the Five Came Back documentary about the directors who went to World War II and came back and made more movies, and I was like, oh, it actually like has a few interesting things to say about, you know, soldiers and coming back from war and like really PTSD before anybody was talking about PTSD. And so you know, from that like cultural standpoint, I can see why this is an important movie and why people still latch onto it and kind of uphold it as one of the best. But I think it's just very badly dated. It falls into some real cliched, like romantic and like important movie tropes, and it drags a lot too. It doesn't really deal in subtlety in anything that it discusses. Like, it kind of hits everything over the head pretty hard. And, it also has some, you know, dated sociology to go along with it. Like, one of the big hurdles that one of the characters faces when he comes back is the fact that his wife wants to work, and he's like, that's like one of the struggles of the soldier. It's like, I was like, I don't care for that opinion at all, really. Like, you know,
it's not a struggle you identify with, Patrick.
they kind of go out of their way to kind of villainize that character too, who's married to one of the soldiers, where they kind of make her just like this party girl who, like, you know, just wants to go out and have a good time and is always nagging her husband.
Oh, terrible.
I was just like,
yep. Like Stella Dallas.
I couldn't, yeah, I just couldn't.
It's a lot of fun.
I couldn't hang with that. I was like, nah, you guys got off on you got like way off track on this one. But yeah, the other stuff I probably would have been okay with, but it's handled so bluntly. Like, it just doesn't he never comes up with any good metaphors. Everything's just like very literally handled, and I was just like, eh, I don't care for this at all.
That's kind of a bummer. I would say when that came up as a possible one, I was a little disappointed it didn't get picked, because it was in my like probably like top three or five movies that I wanted to see off the AFI that I never have.
Mm-hmm. And I will say that the movie itself does get started really well. Like the beginning of it, I was actually kind of excited, because there's this whole sequence where the ostensible main character of the movie is going through an airport coming back from the war, and it does kind of like, it sets up this neat little dynamic where he's kind of flabbergasted by a lot of stuff that's happening around him. There's like this really rich guy at the airport who's just like, you know, I don't know what he just has like a golf bag with him, and he's got this like black guy as his valet, and the soldier's kind of like side-eyeing him a little bit, and the guy's just like paying a bunch of extra money to put his golf clubs on the plane and stuff like that, and he's just like, and then there's this whole thing where the soldier has to, you know, get shipped out to like a military part of the airport so that he can find a flight home, because all the flights to the place where he's going are booked, so he has to like wait around in this hangar all day, and it sets up a weird dynamic that the movie just doesn't continue from there, and I wish it had, you know, been, I don't know, like more disillusioning than it is. It ends up in this really kind of like cliched, you know, like, oh, he shouldn't be with her, he should be with this, you know, this nice loving woman who doesn't have a job, who will stay at home.
Perfect.
It's just like, eh.
Yeah.
It may be one of the first things to discuss PTSD, but we know that the best is Ilya's paper on Taxi Driver.
Wow. Thank you for that, Ruben.
That's a deep
thank you for that shout out to
listeners.
My paper.
Basil?
I'll go ahead and keep the announcement train rolling and announce The Endless from this year. Mm-hmm. It's Aaron Moorhead. What?
I said it's very short.
Yeah, not short enough. Clocking in at 97 eternal minutes. But it's Aaron Moorhead and Justin, I forget his last name, but they made some pretty big waves a few years ago with Spring, which was like a kind of indie horror movie that got a lot of critical acclaim and a lot of people on Letterboxd really loved. And then I never watched it, but I was like, oh, people like that movie, I'll watch this movie. And I sure didn't like it. It's made on a pretty low budget, and they really kind of try to compensate way too hard for their low budget. So there's a lot of like gratuitous drone footage of like overhead shots and like sweeping drone camera things and like strange slow motion follow shots. And I'm like, I don't know why you're doing this except to show that you could. Like, it doesn't feel like it's adding anything to the mood or the kind of creepiness. It's a movie about two young guys who escaped from a cult like a little over 10 years ago, and one of them wants to go back to the cult to find
closure. I sure did not want to see that movie. Now I definitely never will.
And so they decide to go back to get closure, and the directors cast themselves as the two lead characters, and apparently they didn't do that at their previous movie, and they should have continued that, because they're both extremely bad actors, especially the one who plays the kind of like main character, the one that has the more screen time. He does a whole lot of waggling of his eyebrows when he talks. He's either like doing like the furrowed like, this is a very serious thing that I'm saying, or when he's like skeptical, he always like raises his eyebrow a lot when he's like, okay, man. And it's very boring. Saw it with Haley, and literally as soon as the credits started, she whispered to me, "That was terrible." She couldn't wait another second to tell me how bad she thought it was.
Classic Hales.
Yep.
Cool.
But, Ilya?
So building off that, the first thing I'd like to herald is having been in Portland just now for like almost a week. That was really awesome.
Yeah, it was.
Stayed with Basil for what, 4 or 5 days?
Yeah, five days.
Hung out, went out clubbing, went out dancing, went all around Portland, and had a really nice time.
Did exclusively legal activities.
Obviously, yeah. That's all we get up to on this podcast, is exclusively legal activities. Met Haley, who was awesome. Love Haley.
Yeah, she's
and
the best.
All of Basil's friends that I'd say most of all of his friends that I met were really nice, great people. Mm-hmm. And the ones that he doesn't like, I also didn't like, so we're all in accordance on that. And they shall remain nameless. But otherwise, what a great time. And just to like sneak in a movie thing, I also watched Downsizing on the way over on the plane. And I really like that movie. I would
That's
probably...
That's because it's good and you're smart.
Yay. Yay. I suppose I'd give like a certain credence to the people that were a bit concerned about the Vietnamese actresses. I forget her name.
Hong Chau.
But Hong Chau's characters, accent, being played for laughs. My guess is that it was not intended that way, but I would give them enough like respect to say that, okay, maybe some people would perceive it that way and that's gross. I'm sure maybe being in an audience of people who would laugh at that accent would probably make me uncomfortable as well. All in all, I would say that probably Matt Damon's character in that movie is treated, if not the same, but probably somewhat similar to Broderick's character in Election. As in, he thinks that he's probably helping. He thinks that he's probably doing something good, but all in all, he really isn't. And like, there's a lot of ways in which either his character or the characters he surrounds himself with are taking advantage of all the POC characters in that movie that are sidelined, I think, with some intention. Most obviously through like the presence of Christoph Waltz's character, who's basically this guy that just like is like this jet-setting weirdo that just makes money somehow off of the backs of the POC characters that
by
like,
already
have
having
no
money.
Place
That's
in that
how he
movie.
Makes money.
Exactly, he has too much fun. He has so much fun that he just makes money off of it, and that's great. Mm-hmm. Good for him. No, but all in all, I thought that movie was I don't know, way way smarter than it seems. Maybe on first watch or on first glance, but I thought it had a lot of interesting commentary, was a lot of while also like fun made. Like I liked the sets and everything like that. I would probably be in agreement with I think both Basil and Ruben that have already praised it. So, well done.
Yeah, and Mitchell.
Way to go, Alexander Payne.
And Mitchell too. Yeah, right. Yeah, you liked it too. Shout out to Mitchell too, who I met in New York. Yay, twice.
Yeah.
Well, I watched a movie that was very not smart, so I will denounce it for being bad. It's called Man, Woman, Wanted. It's a Polish film from the 70s. Kind of a farce about a guy who works in an art museum and one of the paintings goes missing. And so they're going to send him to jail because he was responsible for that storeroom or whatever. And he decides the solution is he's going to forge the painting, but while he does it, he's going to dress up as a woman so he can hide out from the police. And then all sorts of hilarious hijinks ensue, like him not being able to cook, you know, because he's a man. And it's like an infomercial scene where the pots are all boiling over and he like grabs the hot pots without using like oven mitts and stuff like that. Because I don't even know who that joke is on exactly, the men are just right. such unbelievable idiots that they can't figure out not to touch something that's hot. And then, of course, all the men in the world are, like, constantly amazed by all the things that he can do. Like, at one point, he runs by someone, and they, like, clock his time. And they're like, I'm an Olympic coach. You should join my Olympic women's team. Huh. And I'm like, oh, good. Let's confirm the stereotype that, like, an average shitty dude is, like, better than the best woman athletes in the entire world.
Right.
At another point, he's working as a maid for an architect, and he, like, has an argument with him about some architecture thing, and the guy's like, whoa, that's really smart. Where did you learn all that? And it's like, on the one hand, if the character were a woman, maybe it would be kind of confronting these stereotypes, but in fact, it's actually just reaffirming them, because yeah. he's just a man in drag. And that's why he's so good at stuff. Yep. Not because the sexism against women is bad.
It's because it's true. Yep. How did you even hear this movie? I hadn't even heard of it before you.
I don't remember.
Oh, Poland.
How does anyone hear about anything?
When I was making the list of movies to watch, I did use Critic or some, the feature where, like, you can do limitations, so I probably, like, set it to Poland before 1980, and then was just, like, mm-hmm. looking at the lists and picked one.
Sure, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Can't wait to not watch this movie I never would have heard of.
Yeah.
The art direction's good.
Nice.
It's the only reason why I didn't give it a half star. Also, there's a really funny gag involving Sewer Man where he's biking by him and he's lost and he's like, hey, how do you get to so-and-so place? And, like, he's leaning over and he's got his hands in the sewer and then he pulls up a second person's head out of the sewer and the second person's like, you go down the street this way. I thought that was really funny.
Nice.
But that's it. That's all the positive things I can say about this movie. Sewer joke and cool paintings.
Art direction. Yeah, nice.
Was this Patrick's pick?
Yep.
I think so.
Oh. Uh-huh. And that was me, Ruben, talking. Ruben, now Patrick. Tell us about On the Waterfront.
Coming back to me. All right. On the Waterfront. Starts in I think it's New Jersey or New York, somewhere. I'm not sure exactly. Somewhere in the Northeast.
Starts on the waterfront. It's
on
right
the
in
waterfront.
The title.
Yep. Down by the docks. Marlon Brando's character, Terry, is brothers with a guy named Charlie, who's the right-hand man to a sort of mob boss who runs the local union. Terry tricks a fellow worker into coming up to the roof, and he thinks the mob guys are going to talk to him, but they end up throwing him off the roof. So it begins this huge internal conflict with whether or not Terry should rat on the mob and give the authorities all the info he knows. There's also a romantic subplot with a character whose name I forget that's played by Eva Marie Saint. But in the end, Terry, after his brother Charlie is killed, basically decides, that's it, I'm going to go to the police. And it sort of sets up the final confrontation between him and the mob boss and the workers also, and the head of the union, basically. Mm-hmm. So, that's it.
Yeah. All right. Basil. Yeah, going first, Basil here. I didn't like this movie. I thought it was, like, pretty corny, and there's a point at the movie where I thought, okay, this feels like the end of the movie, and then there's about, like, 25 more minutes after that where they kind of tie up every single plot in, like, a little bow over and over, and I was like, well, I guess I see why people love this movie from a screenwriting perspective, because it's all the annoying things that everyone loves to do in Hollywood screenwriting, where you gotta tie up every last one of them. And then I Googled it because I wasn't 100% sure afterwards, but this movie was made like a year or two after Ilya Kazan had testified in front of the House of Un-American Activities Committee. And that makes the reading of this movie a little gross because you're like, oh, you can see Brando's character as kind of
a little
like stand-in. Yeah. Just be like, oh, see, you know, it's not snitching. You get, when you see people doing awful things like murdering people or being communists, you got to say something. You got to do the right thing.
Two equally bad.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, boy.
So, obviously, that little extra bit of information rubs me the wrong way in a pretty serious way. Ilya?
Yeah, 100% agree on that. We might get into that a little bit later if we discuss the Kazan stuff at all. Mm-hmm. I'd say I tried to pay attention to the acting in this movie that got a lot of praise in general. So I think, you know, Marlon Brando looks really weird in this movie because of this prosthetic eye makeup that is like very obvious. It makes him look very sad in every single scene that he's in, kind of like a puppy. And it's like, it's a bit weird. I thought there were like good moments of acting in this movie. I have to quote from him and like Lee Cobb, who plays the main gangster guy. I think he was pretty good in it. I thought Eva Marie Saint was pretty bad. I thought like a few others were really bad. And in general, like, this movie feels like a theater director made it because they have a lot of scenes in it with like a lot of people in the frame where like everyone is supposed to do something. And that kind of filmmaking, like formally, there is like certainly something about it that might be impressive, but also it's just really distracting because it's just like, I'm not sure that any of that really adds to anything in this movie. It's just like, I guess formally it's impressive when 12 people have something to do in one scene, but I'm not sure that means anything towards this movie at all, because once we are introduced to Johnny's whatever, like the mob boss's gang, none of them really have much to do in this movie afterwards anyway. So all the cool stuff about...
they all got cool faces.
Exactly. And like all the cool faces and all the cool things that they do in that scene, they don't really get much again to do later. Like it's
mobile
just kind of
direction.
A waste. So, yeah, so yeah, I'd say yeah. Overall, I didn't like this movie, and the few moments of like good acting or whatever that it contains, and the generally like competent direction that it has does not really mask a lot of the shortcomings at all for me.
I would disagree with Ilya. I like Eva Marie Saint. I will not disagree with Ilya, and I will say this movie is garbage. I don't know if that means that I'm the person who likes it the least so far, but I went into it kind of like I went into Breakfast at Tiffany's, like expecting one bad thing, which in that case was Mickey Rourke's Asian stereotype, and in this case it was going to be the thinly veiled anti-communist plotline, and was totally blindsided by the horrible garbage romance in this movie that has every bad, like, terrible stereotype decision in it. Like, here's an abusive guy who has a good heart, and you should look past every horrible thing that he does to you because you love him.
Including murdering your brother.
Is there anything... Well...
He doesn't murder
him.
He didn't
want anything to do with that. But like he shows
but he did
up
break into his
apartment.
Girlfriend's apartment and like throw her against the wall.
He shows up at her apartment and he's like, "Do you love me?" And she says, "Go away." And he's like, "You didn't say you didn't love me." And she said, "No, I said go away," which is a fairly clear signal as to what you're supposed to do. But we're supposed to find that, I don't know, entrancing
romantic,
or romantic that he sees through her facade of consent to the real beating heart of non-consent underneath. And I was like, I was already pretty off board at that point, but I was like, threw my computer in the air. It's like, I hate Marlon Brando's performance. I think I Could Have Been Somebody's speech is one of the worst acted moments I've ever seen in any film. Yeah, I really don't like this movie, and I think the fact that it's very clear to me that Ilya Kazan is kind of a good director, that there's a lot of stuff that is well staged, sort of makes me more angry, because it makes it more propagandistic, makes it a better delivery right. vehicle mm-hmm. for this awful garbage messages. All right, now Patrick, you loved it.
5 stars. No, I think I'm probably in contention with you, Ruben, for hating it. I think that this movie has like had a very steep downward trajectory in terms of my watching of it, because this is the third time that I've seen it, and I, you know, like learned about the, you know, extra textual reading of Ilya Kazan basically like using it as his defense for why he, you know, like named names to Huac, and that, like, watching it with that in mind, I hate it. But like, even if I divorce the movie from its extra textual reading, like, this movie is boring. Like, yeah. It's just yeah. dull. None of it is exciting. It's I at least was like, all right, I kind of remember there being like some drama or something, and then his like his brother's involved, but like, it, a lot of the performances feel like they're in different movies, because yeah. the guy who plays Johnny Friendly feels like he's in like an over the top gangster movie, and Brando's yeah. doing his like, you know, his like, I don't what's the like Stanislavski thing where he's like
yeah.
very like ground, like trying to be grounded and real, and kind of like kind of mumbling half his lines, and like it it doesn't work. Like it just feels so like out of place with the rest of what's going on. Like, if it had just been like kind of a heightened gangster story, I might have bought that more. I don't know who I would have cast in it instead, but I could see somebody like actually acting like they're in a gangster movie, and like, I don't know, like this would be too late for him, but like,
Edward James G. Robinson could have played this role, Marlon Brando's role,
you know, earlier.
I have seen.
Do what?
I have a comment about that. I actually think that this is supposed to be a musical, especially with this Leonard Bernstein score, like when it starts off and it's like, you know, the overture or whatever, and I'm like, why aren't people singing and dancing in this obvious musical where like their heightened emotions would sort of fit instead of this weird, bad, overacted nonsense?
And also score... Carl Malden's character, the priest, is actually like, he's over the top too, because he's like making these speeches about how it's like their, you know, godly duty to, you know, defend your fellow man or whatever, and he's like, you know, he's making these, he's doing these big speechifying scenes, and then you have scenes
he's a
where
cool priest
Marlon
though
Brando's
he's a priest
like muttering,
he's a priest that
like...
smokes.
You know, I'm gonna love a movie when the moral center heroes of the film are the police and the church. Fuck this
movie's really challenging the status quo there.
Haley pointed that out too, like especially the scenes between Brando and Ava Marie Saint, because she's doing a much more like traditional style of like 50s acting, and it's just like they have like no chemistry together because of that, because they're just like especially in the anytime there's like a shot reverse shot with them, it's like cutting between two completely different movies. It's like, here's this movie. Oh, now you're looking at this completely other movie.
Yeah,
They're not having a conversation at all.
The one scene I liked between both of them was when Brando takes one of her gloves.
That's very funny.
He takes one of her gloves and he sits down on like a swing or something, and he starts like putting on one of her glove like in the middle of talking. So he has one of them on his hand and she has one of the others on her hand. And it's like, it looks really funny because he's doing it really like nonchalantly while also talking to her. And I'm like, wow, this is like the one scene where anyone in this movie is like having fun with any of this material. Like,
so you're saying you didn't like the scene where he was confessing what happened and had those loud steamboat noises so they didn't have to write dialogue?
You can't hear what he's saying. Oh my God. Yeah.
Stop doing that, writers. There's nothing mysterious or romantic about not writing dialogue for a scene.
Yeah.
Just makes you seem lazy.
It's true.
We're bad at your job.
Yeah. Bill Murray just whispering. Could be whispering anything. It's like, I have to go to the bathroom. So,
yeah. I've got to leave. I've really got to go. I'm sorry.
I want to make Ghostbusters too.
Yeah, but yeah, and it's also weird because the Leonard Bernstein score is like so in the way all the time. Like during that, I could have been a contender part. I was like, what the hell is this music? It's like so intensely over the top. And then he's like very over the top and the writing's very over the top. And I was like, man, this is really pounding me in the face. And it's like a weird thing where, like Ilya said, with the theater aspect of it, like there's no way that car looks like it's going anywhere. Like it just yeah. It just looks like a car, like, you know, like a prop car sitting on a stage, and they're just
I mean, Ilya Kazan was a theater director pretty famously.
He sure was.
That was his whole reason for naming names, was that he had a falling out with the communists in the theater company that he used to be in, and so his falling out basically led to him just being like, "Fuck you guys, I'm gonna name names." And the elements of this movie that I find the most egregious are the ones that I actually kind of like, or like the scene where he goes back up to the rooftop and the kid has like killed all of the pigeons that they were raising.
I don't think the kid did it. I think he just found them.
Oh, well,
I thought it was implying that the kid did it out of
revenge. They made the kid.
Yeah, I thought that they had like told him to do it or something, because they
maybe.
I just assumed because he like takes. Yeah, he does, like, throws
a bird at him, though. A dead bird. Who does?
Yeah,
that?
He throws the pigeon at him, and I was like, "This is actually like the saddest part of this movie right here." Like, I didn't care about any of the people that died, but all these pigeons, like,
I don't care about the pigeons either.
I actually thought that was the saddest part of the movie, but then I was like, if you add back in the extra textual reading where it's just Ilya Kazan being like, I don't have any friends anymore because I ratted them all out to this unconstitutional committee.
Yeah.
I'm so sad. It's like, fuck you douchebag. Get out of my face with that.
Real piece
of garbage. God. Yeah, that like that burns me up on a whole different level where he's just like, yeah, I'm just like this tough guy.
I guess
who
the
got
scene
real beat up.
That made me sad in the movie is when the priest is like, we should love each other and help each other out. Everyone is your brother, and I was like, that's communism. You're describing the thing that you're against.
Yep.
You idiot.
Yeah. The problem
with
the
said.
Yeah, the problem with the metaphor that, you know, that he's supposedly creating like an anti-communism metaphor, like the metaphor that he's created, the mob being in control of a union, is a problem of capitalism. Like it's a problem of capitalism.
Mafia's extreme capitalism.
Yeah, it's a problem of capitalism seeping into the power structure that's set up. And it's like you still need that union in place, but you need to get the mob out of it. Like,
yeah, there's an offhanded comment at one point about how most of the unions in the country are good.
Yeah,
they're fine. Yeah, bad. There is.
It's like, what? I'm like, you like really bad at defending yourself.
Yeah, his metaphor doesn't even work.
Yeah, I thought that too, because going into it, I was expecting it to just be like an anti-union thing of like, all unions are corrupt, we got to get rid of them. But like, they make it pretty explicit that it's like, no, it's just like mafia infiltration of some unions. The union is still a good thing. And I was like,
well, what is them better, deciding also not to work until Terry gets to walk in the ship, but a union strike?
Right. That's socialism.
Empowering the workers.
Right. That's the workers controlling the means of production. You guys, come on. So, yeah. I also just like am way over the whole thing of like, oh, this woman wants to be a nun. Like, that's what her goal is, to like be a nun, to contrast her with him, where he's like the rough and tumble guy who's gonna break through her like chaste facade of wanting to be a nun and like excite her desires. I'm like, oh my god, this fucking goddamn trope. Like, I feel like I've seen it too many times.
Yeah, it's like way too
many. The woman is like involved in something where she's like so sweet and chaste, and then she meets this like rough and tumble guy. You know, it's like the, I don't know, like the Billy Joel song "Uptown Girl" or something.
Right.
That's that's the depth of that trope. Yeah. It's like a doo-wop.
Yeah,
song
there's
from
also
the 80s.
A pretty gross line with her dad that seems very sincere when he's like, "Oh, you know, an innocent woman like you shouldn't have to see things like this." Or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, yeah, they do that a lot. Where there's like,
yeah, we didn't put quarters. We didn't put quarters in this thing for years, so you wouldn't go to Catholic school, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In this case, his gross reasoning is wrong, but his actual advice is right. She should not be with Marlon Brando.
That is a good thing. Get away from him.
Speaking of, yeah.
Oh, I was just gonna say, yeah. Don't date anyone who kisses you into submission.
Mm-hmm.
Gross.
Oh.
Yeah, and more gross tropes. We of course have to include a line where he says he remembers seeing her as a child, and he's like, "You grew up nice."
Ugh. Yeah, that's yeah. Right. He did say that. You grew up nice. Oh my god. Yeah, that again, like, it's another, like, crazily outdated thing that I feel like...
I don't think that was ever indated.
Yeah, but, like, I definitely... there was a... oh my
gosh.
Up
to 2007, people sort of thought so.
Yeah, there was
They're like, this is one of the 100 best movies that the United States has ever produced.
Yeah, there was an Onion article that was, like... it was just young girl going to grow up into very pretty woman to please some man or something like that. And it was just like interviews with people saying that sort of horrible shit where they're like, she's going to be really attractive one day or something like that. And I was like, oh my God. It's, yeah, it's a very like horrendous thing to have, especially.
Well, Stanley Kubrick called him the best, one of the best directors we are lucky to have working right now. Mm. And Nicholas Ray called him the best actors director the U.S. has ever produced. So, a lot of people really like this guy. So.
He's wrong.
Nicholas Ray is that person. Yeah. He didn't
want to
say himself.
Nicholas Ray sadly didn't have Quentin Tarantino's ego.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I'm still curious to see, because I do agree there are like technical elements of the movie, especially visually, that sometimes work for me. Like a face in the crowd I've never seen, and heard's pretty cool. And
I wrote down cool dawn shots.
I was gonna say I remember liking his Streetcar Named Desire adaptation the last time I saw it. So. Mm-hmm. Maybe,
yeah, I'd be curious to watch that as well.
Maybe going into that, where the subject matter is brought by Tennessee Williams instead of Bud Schulberg. Yeah.
What did y'all think of all the shots of the fences in between the actors? Like, almost every time people talk to each other, it's like through a fence or something like that. It's like, okay, I get it. I guess some people are in a prison of their own making, but do you have to make that... metaphor every single time? Like, is everyone in a prison of their own making at this point?
They sure are. Capitalism.
Yeah.
And toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
He really wasn't aware of that problem.
No. No, he wasn't.
I meant to say earlier, when we were talking about how the movie was boring, some screenwriter was like, it's flagging a little bit. You know what'll pick this movie up? Trial scene. we're rounding third. I know what we need. People are sitting still and talking at the camera.
We need somebody banging a gavel. Every third line or something.
And it's, it's weird that it's, well, so heralded, because I feel like all the tropes that people talk about being bad about screenwriting are, like, here. Like, the scene with his brother, even divorced of, like, the bad acting in it, like, it's like the movie's almost over and you're, like, retroactively trying to make their relationship meaningful, because they probably only exchange, like, 12 lines of dialogue between each other the whole rest of the movie, and then suddenly he's like, you were my brother, you should have looked out for me, and it's like, oh, he cares about his brother, now I see
yeah.
it. And it's like this feeling yeah. that I never felt up until this moment.
It's a very artificial connection between those two.
Yeah. I mean, even the boxing story isn't particularly fleshed out, but
no.
it's like supposed to be central to his character that he, you know, is very sad about this shot that he gave up.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. For some easy money. Fixing fights.
Yeah, I
also boxing.
Think that
weird sport to.
It's interesting to me that, like, Brando's weird performance doesn't jive well here, because I remember really liking the way that his weird performance doesn't jive well with Julius Caesar, the Joseph Mankiewicz Julius Caesar, because the rest of the cast in that movie is doing, you know, like, they're all like English stage actors doing Shakespeare, and Brando's like walking around just like picking pieces of dust off of people's togas and shit, and he's just like doing that weird, you know, like Stanislavski thing while these guys are sitting there and they're saying Shakespeare. And I thought that, like, that adaptation is actually, like, pretty funny and pretty good from what I remember, which again, like, adds a new element to Shakespeare where I'm like, maybe Shakespeare was kind of taking the piss out of Julius Caesar, now that I think about it.
Shakespeare's a funny dude.
Especially, like, considering the, you know, I don't know, sort of, like, meta reading of Romeo and Juliet, where you could be like, this might be a satire on romance instead of just a great romance.
Shakespeare was a woman, guys. Like, let's adhere to the current level of studies.
Let's put it out there.
Yeah.
I believe it. But that, I mean,
she was a funny dude.
Awesome. Excellent. Wonderful. But no, yeah, that weird Brando performance actually, like, worked for me because it was so discordant with what else was going on. Whereas here it kind of, I don't know, I guess it feels like it might be able to fit in if he was, like, a background character, but too much of him in this where he's just, like, muttering and, like, doing weird things and being awful.
Yeah, chewing gum.
chewing gum and...
Yeah.
Now you know I was a fighter. Why did you do the thing?
I do like the way he chews gum, though. It's very strange. I mean, not the way he chews it, but when he puts it in his mouth, he, like, takes the stick out and, like, bites little bites off until he has the whole stick in his mouth. And I was like, that's a weird way to chew gum.
Like a sandwich.
He's making choices. He was making a lot of big choices. That's one thing I'll say for Brando. He does make choices.
Yep.
I like the rowdy wedding scene, even though I don't really understand its placement in this film.
Right.
It's just in a bar and everyone is drunk and the people in the wedding are just pushing people around.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very strange.
The piano players just like...
Kind of reminds me of... what's
Docks
his name?
Of New York.
Yep, that's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great wedding scene in that, too.
I wonder. It has to be a reference. There's no way.
Definitely, yeah.
Because
I think these are also the Docks of New York. Unfortunately, Marlon Brando doesn't throw barrels at anyone like Donkey Kong.
It's true. Also, this movie isn't nearly as pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Still true. Just as masculinely toxic, though.
Yeah. Needed Sternberg's eye.
Yep.
Uh,
Mm-hmm. I really don't have anything else to say about this movie.
Me neither, honestly.
We ran through it pretty fast. Like,
I have one other thing to say, which is that the cops keeps trying to muscle Terry by saying that, like, the people deserve the facts, that they need to know the truth, that they need the facts of the situation. And it remind me of, like, bad, boring centrists who think that information is the solution to problems as opposed to, like, actual change. And constantly think that emotion isn't part of reasoning as well. I mean, that's a slightly separate issue. But they think that the problem is that people are ignorant, which is, I guess, kind in a way, because being ignorant is better than being horrible. But for the most part, they're just horrible and fine with it.
Yeah. Ben Shapiro, he loves to talk about facts. Facts don't care about your feelings.
Oh, yep. God.
But also, he doesn't care about facts.
It's true. So.
People who like to talk a lot about facts don't usually care about them that much.
That was it. That was my last comment.
All right.
All cops are bastards.
ACAB, baby.
One of my notes. My best note, we already mentioned, which is in all caps I wrote down, did he throw a dead pigeon at him?
He sure did.
Yeah. Rude kid.
The kid was crying, though. I mean, they made him do it. It was not his idea. So I don't blame him.
Okay.
I just assume that kid was really indoctrinated, though. Like, I just assume he was like, oh, you ratted. You're a rat. Nobody likes a rat.
It's also possible that the actor who played the kid really didn't want to throw a dead pigeon at Marlon Brando and was crying, and he still made him do it the same way they made the kid in the movie do it.
Method.
Because he was off camera screaming at him. Do it!
Sometimes you gotta do the right thing, kid. Even though it feels bad.
They really killed all those pigeons, too. They're not like dolls or anything.
Yeah.
That's They're like, all right, movie's done shooting. Nothing to do with these pigeons now. Let's just kill them.
Like that tweet about the war on drugs. Like, we should continue it because all the dog canines will probably have to be
euthanized
if we don't.
Oh, God.
It's a good reason.
There's literally nothing else to do with them but to kill them all.
God.
Jesus.
I saw a thing saying that they were apparently trying to train, like, rabbits to be able to sniff drugs, too. And someone, of course, was like, stop turning animals into cops. Exactly.
So they were trying to make, like, Zootopia in real life.
Yeah,
exactly.
Man, I really should become an expert jewel thief and carry a fox around with me to defend against the rabbit cubs. Yep.
I should have thought to do that, except I probably wouldn't pay the money. I saw the someone dressed as the Zootopia rabbit taking pictures, but I think it was like $10 a picture, but it'd be cool to do that and hold up a sign that says, fuck the police, for my picture.
Good times.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
All right.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you're enjoying the podcast. If so, please subscribe using your podcast listening application. Give us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which is now easier for reasons stated in previous podcasts. You can also go to our website, loosecannons.com. No, loosecannons.
.net.
Not .net. And find all of our content. And you can go to our Patreon now, patreon.com/loosecannons. Same way as it's spelled for the website. And give us money. Join current Patreons, Adam Underwood, Michael Quinn, and Durst Nora.
Give us money.
Yep. And if you give us enough money, we'll make things for you.
We sure will.
If you want to watch next week's movie, it is going to be Rebecca, Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca, which is not on the AFI list. It just sounds like it is.
It's from the UK, technically.
It is
so.
The only Hitchcock film to win Best Picture. So
oh,
that's it carries that distinction.
go watch Rebecca and join us next week. But for now, right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ilya
Kazan.
I know who directed it.